Thank you, Courtney, and welcome everyone. A very good morning from sunny Leeds. My name is Colin Storer, CFO of Garfunkel's Hall Court 2. I'd like to extend you all a very warm welcome for joining us this morning as we review our Q3 17 results. It's a quarter that can only be characterised as, I guess, transformative, but also very exciting for us. Alongside me is our Group CEO, James Cornell, the longest serving CEO in the industry. And I know that's a statistic that he really hates, but it's worth calling out as the group really does benefit from his many years of experience, critically because they're gained during both the peaks and troughs of the economic cycle. Now, you'll notice a couple of small changes to our results call today. Firstly, it's a little longer because we've got so much that we wish to cover with you. And secondly, we're also sharing the presentation via webcast. That said, if you do wish to refer to the presentation after the call, both this document and the interim financial statements are, as ever, available to download from our investor relations website, which is www.lowellgroup.com. And the slides we'll talk through today capture the trading results of the Garfunkel's Holdcore 2 entity, which, following our group rebrand, we refer to as Lowell. To help you understand and appreciate the group's ongoing growth and development and substance, we've included some non-IFRS insight and year-on-year comparisons, both for the 3 months to September 17 and also for the last 12 months to the same date. And with particular regard to the 12 months comparative to September 16, these numbers are the combination of the trading results of Metis Bidco Limited and Lowell Financial Services GmbH, given that Lowell acquired both of these entities during the course of 2015.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you once again for taking the time to join us. Before Colin takes you through the detail of the strength of our Q3 numbers, I'd like to start today by taking you through slide 6. We've shown the slide before, and I'm sure we'll do so again. Hello. It's important that I describe what we do, as this explains how we build our business and why we're different, and of course, why I believe we're better than others in our sector. Our strategy guides all that we do as a group, and is one that we have delivered robustly against once more in this quarter. Our ambition is realized through focus on four drivers: growth, diversification, customer centricity, and data insight. These frame the details that Colin will take us through shortly. It is only through relentless pursuit of these drivers that we further improve the financial well-being of our clients and of our consumers. This matters, and it's important that we do it really well. On 2nd of November, we were excited to announce the acquisition of the carve-out business from Interim, an opportunity fully aligned to our strategic objectives, an acquisition that makes Lowell the largest and most comparable competitor to Interim, both in terms of scale and business mix. The acquisition cements our leadership position within the European credit management space and makes us a market leader across the Nordic region. The exposure to the mature and sophisticated Nordic region increases the diversified profile of the group, not just from a geographic perspective, but further rebalances our business mix from debt purchase to capital light 3PC activities. I'm personally excited for the growth opportunities that exist for the combination of Lowell and the carve-out business, and I'm really looking forward to welcoming all of the team into the wider Lowell family. During the quarter, we also successfully completed the refinancing of our Euro 405 million floating rate note, with many bondholders rolling their investment, a strong testimony to the confidence in our business and the results that we generate. Through this one transaction alone, we've reduced our weighted average cost of debt by 0.5%. In addition, the strength of the order book allowed us to complete the refinancing in a very short time frame, reinforcing our reputation as a repeat and successful issuer. At this point, I'd like to express my personal thanks to all of those who have provided and continue to provide support to the group. So once again, thank you. What delights me perhaps the most is that throughout all of this corporate and refinancing activity, the group and our people have retained a focus on our trading and core activities, a focus that has enabled us to deliver, once again, another set of strong results, continuing to grow the business and invest for the long term despite what has been a very, very, very busy quarter.
Certainly has been a busy quarter, so let me step back and try and bring alive our Q3 numbers in a little more detail. So if I start on slide 7, where we've seen a 21% increase in cash income for the 3 months to September 17 versus the prior year period, noting once again that we define cash income as cash collections from owned assets plus fees and commissions we receive from assets that we service on behalf of others. On a last 12 months basis, our cash income is once again over the £500 million bright line and has grown by some 29% year on year. Pleasingly, this has been driven by growth across both gross cash collections from assets owned, but also from amounts earned from the management of debt on behalf of third parties. The former is up 23%, the latter up some 60%, with this growth predominantly driven by our two acquisitions in the DACH region in 2016. The group also continues to deliver sustainable and sustained cash EBITDA growth, as you can see on slide 8. For the 3 months to September 17, we achieved cash EBITDA for just that 3 month period of 78 million, an increase on the prior period of 12%. And actually, that number is indeed up 9%, or some 7 million, from the figure that we recorded just 3 months ago in the 3 months to June 17 numbers. Stepping back and looking at the bigger picture, for the last 12 months to September 17, our cash EBITDA stands some 19% higher versus the prior year figure. Our last 12-month cash EBITDA number to September 17 is 293 million. And the faster top-line growth in our 3PC income has naturally seen the contribution from 3PC increase year on year. The proportion of capital-light 3PC business now stands at 19%, up from 16% in the prior period, and this uptick explains the very slight softening in our cash EBITDA margin on a last 12-month basis. Now, slide 9 and 10, they are both intended to show both the consistency and repeatability of our growth. Slide 9 demonstrates the sustained cash EBITDA growth we've delivered since coming together as a group. Since our first set of group results back in December 15, the business has continually stepped up its last 12 months cash EBITDA number, period on period. As at September 17, our cash EBITDA is 38% or 81 million higher than the comparable figure that we first reported at December 2015. On slide 10, growth is also clear in terms of our expected collections going forward. Our 120-month ERC now stands at just under 2 billion, 1.95 billion, and that's an increase of nearly 300 million or 18% year on year. I think it's also important not just to talk about the scale of our ERC balance, but also to reiterate the upfront nature of our curve. We expect to collect some £750 million over the next 24 months alone. That's a front-loaded collections profile that provides us with great visibility of our future cash flow generation, as you can see on the chart on slide 11. But it also critically provides you with a hedge against economic deterioration, a mitigant to collection risk, if you like. We also continue to see material value beyond 120 months, with an additional 16% or over £300 million of ERC expected to be collected between years 11 and 15. Now, slide 12 is a real pleasure for me to present. So firstly, let me set a little bit of context around the slide, and I'll then go on to touch upon why this slide is so important to you as bondholders. Each bar on the chart correlates to a specific static pool date and shows the actual collections for the subsequent 12 months compared to the forecast for that period. So the percentages in the dotted box above each of the charts actually shows the actual collections out to the current date, September 17, compared to that same static pool date and forecast. The chart therefore demonstrates way more vividly than I can give an overview to the prudence of our estimated remaining collection forecasts across a number of years and across varied economic times. And despite the economic cycle we've experienced over the past decade or so, the forecasts we've made, underpinned by our data insight and our capabilities, have proven somewhat prudent. We tend to marginally outperform our collection expectations in the first 12 months, and we then tend to significantly outperform across the longer term. If I can just take the December 08 static pool as an example. In the following 12 months, mindful this period was characterised by the depths of the financial crisis, we collected exactly in line with our forecasts, one of the few debt purchasers at the time who are able to demonstrate such a claim. And subsequent to then, we've delivered a period of outperformance, achieving collections of 103% of the forecast we made at December 08 when we roll forward collections to the current day. Now, such performance, taken over a number of years and a number of different vintages, typifies the prudence of our forecasting. And it's the disciplined approach we take to forecasting, to deploying capital, and our ability to apply our data insight and our process innovation that is just so key to that track record of ongoing outperformance. Now, obviously, our track record of prudent forecasting naturally extends itself to our evolution in gross money multiples that you can see on slide 13. We've chosen to focus a little bit more on gross money multiples than we have in the past because we wanted to provide some greater insight as to the evolution of our UK gross money multiples in particular, noting the various comment around pricing and competition. On the slide, we've looked to show the evolution of the gross money multiple across a range of vintages, from when they were initially priced to what we were then expecting 1 year on, and then to where they stand as at the current date, September 17. It's key to point out that we're looking at things here on a static basis. The gross money multiple is shown on a like-for-like static 120-month period across the comparisons. And you can see, yes, there's a consistency of our priced expectations across different vintages. You also see that we've clearly benefited from a very disciplined approach to underwriting. Our price gross money multiples show a degree of variability across vintages depending upon the mix of assets acquired in any one vintage. So, for example, if we have a greater proportion of paying portfolios which exhibit a lower gross money multiple, reflecting the lower risk characteristics of such assets, you would naturally have a slightly lower blended gross money multiple. But what's really important on this chart is that we're able to demonstrate a consistent level of outperformance compared to our underwriting over time. Or put it another way, an enhanced level of returns as vintages mature. I'll move on to slide 14. And we continue to see the benefit of having very diversified origination capabilities. In the last 12 months, we've acquired 337 individual portfolios. We've acquired them from over 70 different clients and across all major unsecured sectors. You know, that is diversification in its most simple sense. This has seen us grow our portfolio acquisitions by 14% year on year, having purchased $271 million worth of assets in the last 12 months, and forward flows account for just under half of our total acquisitions. These ongoing mutually beneficial relationships, as ever, help provide certainty as to our future earnings and are a continued means of providing market insulation post-initial pricing. I think most importantly on this slide, we can demonstrate that we continue to deploy capital not only in a disciplined fashion, but actually in excess of our average replacement rate. And that investment above the average replacement rate provides a continual growth driver for the business. So we see our replacement rate required to maintain our September 17 ERC at around 160 million, calculated completely consistently with calculations of the past, and the figure being based upon next 12-month collections, less the roll-forward collections in the tail, divided by a blended gross money multiple from recent vintages. This means we've invested 125 million over and above that calculation in the last 12 months. 125 million of purchases, which are pure investment capital for the future growth of this business. That in turn is going to facilitate an ever greater balance sheet, ever greater ERC, ever greater collections, ever greater cash EBITDA, and ultimately ever greater protection for those bondholders who invested in earlier issuances when the business was markedly smaller. I'm turning to slide 15, and I'd also like to give some insight as to our ability to delever, not least because the group has already delevered in the very short period between our refinancing and at the end of the quarter. Now, this shows our gross, not our net debt to cash EBITDA position. And our gross debt to the last 12 months cash EBITDA stands at 5.1 times as of September 17, which is down from the pro forma position of 5.2 at the time of financing. This is in line with our group's track record of delivering leverage reduction. With the sustained growth in our cash EBITDA that we've demonstrated earlier being the force which underpins such improvement. Our leverage track record is shown on the bottom right-hand side of the slide. you can see that after key strategic events in our recent history, our original merger with GFKL, the acquisition of Tesh, our most recent refinancing, then we've consistently managed to quickly reduce our leverage within a short timeline thereafter. You know, since coming together as a group, our performance represents a cumulative reduction in our gross leverage ratio of some 0.6 times. And that's an improvement that would have been even greater had we not had to face the FX headwinds that we have. You know, I think it's a really interesting stat that on a June 15 constant currency basis, our current gross leverage at September of 5.1 times would comparably stand at 4.7. And clearly that same dynamic is at play with our net debt to adjusted EBITDA as well. And we've included this because Lowell is a business that can and does quickly deliver, given the strength of our business model and our proven cash flow generation. As such, we're pleased to reaffirm our stated medium-term guidance with regards to leverage of net debt to cash EBITDA drifting to below 4.5 times over the medium term. As at the 30th of September 17, our absolute level of debt stood at $1.4 billion. There was a marginal increase from the prior quarter, which was the incremental 10 million euros we raised during the refinancing of the FRN, alongside an amount of some 14 million sterling that we drew down from an existing securitization facility in the DAC region. You know, the net effect of both the refinancing and that securitization drawdown is that we've lowered our weighted average cost of debt from 7.9% to 7.4%. I think this is an important juncture to provide a little bit more context as to both the timing and quantum of our ability to generate free cash flow and the impact that non-performing loan portfolio acquisitions has upon this. So let me talk you through slide 16, because here we've captured a waterfall view, which starts with our last 12 months cash EBITDA on the left and finishes with our excess cash generation after the average replacement rate for the period on the right-hand side of the page. And I know it's a view that's very familiar to a number of you, but there are a couple of key points I'd like to draw out. Firstly, the starting point of any illustrative cash flow analysis such as this needs to take into account the lagged nature of the cash EBITDA metric. We show a trailing measure, and it takes around 6 months before purchased assets throw off significant monthly cash flow. And this is a critical aspect to note, not least because we actually secured portfolio acquisitions of 125 million in the preceding two quarters to the end of this period. Similarly, although not underpinned by capital investment, some recently enacted 3PC relationships will also take time to reach maturity and also generate incremental cash flows. And as such, you know, one needs to account for the natural step up that the business will see as a result of that purchase activity and those 3PC wins as they start to throw off incremental cash. The second point that I'd make, which is setting aside timing, is that the expected growth in our free cash flow, it can be rationalised by the purchases that we're making in excess of the replacement rate that I've called out earlier. You know, coincidentally, the number which is in excess of the replacement rate is also 125 million, but I'd look upon this as, I guess, investment capital for growth. These purchases will start to generate an ever greater collections, ever greater cash EBITDA over time, and that's going to further help us step up the level of excess cash generation that comes from our business.
I spoke earlier of our delight of announcing the acquisition of the carve-out business from Intrum, and starting on slide 18, I'll provide some further insight to what is a transformative and exciting next step for the group. The carve-out business comprises Lindorf's entire businesses in Sweden, Finland, Denmark and Estonia, as well as Intrum Justicia's entire business in Norway. Our detailed due diligence and engagement with management throughout the acquisition process has provided great insight to what is a well-managed, successful business in its own right, and one that brings with it not only significant revenues, estimated remaining collections and cash generation, but also important client relationships and data. Carve-out business is an integrated business model providing services across the credit management services value chain, namely third-party servicing, debt purchase, and value-add services, a diverse proposition well-aligned to our existing offering. and we firmly believe the business's scale and leading presence in each market means it is well-positioned for further growth opportunities. Moving to slide 19, our acquisition is underpinned by a highly compelling strategic rationale. Combined, the businesses will create the second largest credit management services provider in Europe and makes Laul a market leader in the Nordic region, reinforcing our strategy to operate in sophisticated, large markets from a position of market leadership. The immediate scale and diversity of the combined business is clear in terms of broader geographic reach and a more balanced revenue mix, together with a complementary and client-focused product offering. The acquired business shares our overarching commitment to a fair and principled approach that puts people at the heart of what we do. This ethos will be central to the successful integration of the two businesses and to maintaining, of course, our strategic vision. It is something that is very important to me personally, and I was very pleased to discover what great degree our new colleagues are aligned to that too. Slide 20 demonstrates the leadership position across three core regions that our combined business will benefit from. On both a pro forma estimated remaining collections and cash EBITDA basis, Laul will become the largest and most comparable competitor to Intrum. Turning to slide 21, the scale and diversification the acquisition yields is readily apparent. The group will have a pro forma cash EBITDA of close to £400 million and employ over 4,000 people across eight core countries. The acquisition increases the non-UK centricity of the group, with 44% of pro forma group ERC emanating from the DACH and Nordic regions. Equally, the acquisition helps further rebalance our revenue mix, with around 25% of pro forma cash income coming from capital light third-party servicing and value-add services. As announced earlier, the enterprise value for the acquisition was €730 million, and the transaction will be funded from a combination of new bond issuance and equity from our shareholders. Whilst I cannot be specific at this juncture, I will say that the financing of the transaction is designed such that, in combination with our proven ability to delever, we will not compromise our medium-term leverage guidance. We expect the transaction to close in H1 2018, following completion of the customary approvals from both the EC and from regulators in certain Nordic markets.
And before James brings our presentation to a close, I would like to just provide a view, a very personal view, on the metrics that we choose to disclose each period. As I do believe that if you give them proper context, we remain confident they do provide appropriate insight and transparency to the robustness of our business model. So if I turn to slide 23 and some of the specific points I'd like to make. As a group, we seek to provide investors with transparency of our performance. In that spirit, we obviously produce IFRS financial statements, but we've also consistently disclosed various non-IFRS measures, two of the key ones being cash EBITDA and ERC. If I start with ERC, we present gross estimated remaining collections as it represents the expected gross cash proceeds which will be thrown off our purchased debt portfolios and reflect the undiscounted cash value of our purchased debt portfolios at any point in time. We've never represented this to be anything else. This is a gross value and should be seen in the context of our overall debt position, which is also a gross measure. We disclose ERC so that our investors have a meaningful way to understand where the loan-to-value of our group stands. In addition, and put very simply, cash EBITDA provides insight to the underlying cash flow generation of the business and as such represents the amount of cash that has been generated for debt and tax servicing and future investment opportunities in any given period. It is up to us how we wish to deploy that cash which is generated. In contrast to this, the value of those purchased debt portfolios as captured on the balance sheet and in our accounting reflects the discounted value of the expected gross cash proceeds, using each portfolio's specific EIR. That means that yield and revaluation is subsequently the basis of operating profit. And to aid the understanding of how cash EBITDA is reconciled to accounting profit, we disclose each quarter a detailed reconciliation between both measures, something we're always happy to discuss and bring alive.
The continued strength of our strategy and business model laid out in detail. Thank you, Colin. Let me just now provide some concluding remarks. The outlook for the macro business environment and UK economy continues to be uncertain despite its resilience to date. However, Lal has a strong track record of weathering these economic cycles, as we called out earlier. Against this macro backdrop, we're delighted to be adding a significant third region to our existing UK and DACH platforms. The strategic rationale is compelling, and the underlying aspects of the carve-out business, i.e. the success in developing forward flows and cultivating long-term client relationships, all provide us with further visibility on future business and ever greater stability of earnings. At the same time, we see continued strong momentum across the business. We delivered a further quarter of double-digit percentage growth across our key metrics. We've added key recruits to complement our industry-leading management team, and we've seen a positive start to the fourth quarter, with the UK having seen a new record month of collections in October. We enter the final few months of 2017 with an excess of £250 million of contractually committed purchases, providing both greater visibility for this year, but also beyond, underpinned by what will remain core to us, a disciplined, long-term approach to pricing and investment. We note a number of positive indicators for the wider industry, notably the continued growth in consumer credit in the UK and across Europe, as well as the upcoming adoption of IFRS 9 in 2018. We look forward to announcing our full year results on our next call, which is scheduled for the 12th of April 2018. And with that, we'd like to thank you all for listening and ask the operator to open up the lines for any questions you may have. Thank you once again.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, please press star 2, and you will be advised when to ask your question. Okay, so our first question comes in from the line of Manu, calling from Reorg Research. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. I had a few questions. I'll ask them all in one go, and if you need reminders to do, let me know and I can ask it again. First of all, I see that you haven't disclosed the unrestricted restricted cash breakdown in your accounts. Could you provide that? And what portion of the cash report on the balance sheet was held on behalf of clients?
Do you want to finish the rest of your questions, or shall I answer them piecemeal? If you fire away, then I'll try and remember.
Sure. The second question was to do with debt purchase business, really. So when you take over a portfolio from, say, one of the banks, do you take over the any liabilities associated with that? So I'm thinking about things like PPI, for example. The third question was to do with GDPR. I was reading your OM, and I think there was a lot of risk associated with GDPR, but I was just wondering if you had any update as to how you see that impacting your business going forward, given that I think it's due for implementation next year. And thank you for the update on the acquisition for the carve-out, especially on how you plan to finance it. But I was just wondering, do you have sufficient debt capacity, or will you need to get consent from the bondholders? And the fourth question was to do with, it would be immensely helpful if you could actually give a breakdown of the LTM cash EBITDA by the third-party collections business and the debt purchase business. I see you give a breakdown for the cash income, but I think it would be quite helpful to see the breakdown for the EBITDA as well. And finally, related to that itself, I think you also report the gross cash collections by the individual segments, but I was just wondering if on the third-party collections business, does the gross cash collection actually correspond to revenue earned by the group, or is it total collections made on behalf of the client? Thank you.
Okay, you were right. There was a fair number of questions, which is great.
Sorry about that.
The debate very well. No, please don't apologize. So I think there's a mix of financial accounting and more strategic business questions, which gives, I think, James and I both the opportunity to contribute. So maybe if I just pick off a couple quite quickly. In terms of the cash breakdown, we have 89 million of cash recorded on the balance sheet. $59 million of that is unrestricted, which means that we have, by my simple maths, around $30 million of client monies, which are also on balance sheet. In terms of the point around cash EBITDA split between DP and 3PC, I appreciate it might be helpful, but it's never been a metric that we've disclosed, and we haven't disclosed it this period for the very simple reason that so much of the back office in the different geographies is very difficult to split between the DP and the 3PC businesses. It becomes something of an academic exercise to allocate fixed costs between the two divisions within a given geography. So as a consequence, we've never produced that information, and we haven't done so in this case either. And then lastly, just in terms of your gross collections point, I may have misunderstood what you were driving at, but in terms of ERC, the ERC is our estimated remaining collections purely from assets owned, not from third-party assets managed.
Sorry, can I just pick up on that? I think I'm referring to, I think, page 6 of the report. You give gross cash collections, and then you break it down to the debt purchase business and the third-party collections. I think for the 3 months ended September 30th, it was 236.7 in total, of which 111.4 was to do with the third-party collections. So not related to the ERC, but just collections, cash collections in the period. That's what I was getting at.
Correct, yeah. That 111 is the total cash collections that we've been able to secure on behalf of our third-party clients, and the 3PC income, which is just underneath that number, represents the fees and commissions that we've been able to generate from that collection activity.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
And then on the, I guess, the other two questions. So relating to when we acquire an account or a portfolio, in terms of, I guess, there is beneficiary rights transferred across as well as clearly liabilities. However, on the liabilities, there will be well caveated contractual terms that would cover things like, for instance, having to refund PPI that was deemed to be invalid, for example. So, all of the contracts will be very robustly protecting any of the inherited liabilities that pertain to prior to us owning the debt. And there'll be obviously generic clauses that say that there are warrants in place to warrant that the amounts are legally collectible, etc. On the GDPR one, a couple of things. I guess one, we're well prepared and obviously on track for the coming deadlines. Secondly, ultimately, we don't see any restrictions that will prohibit us from our core activities. And I guess thirdly, as we've always said, and this supports our overall strategy towards customer centricity and ensuring that what we do it well.
And then, sorry, I've just remembered in the plethora of points that you raised, I've foolishly omitted to give you a steer on the point around debt capacity and consent. I think, as James said, we're very mindful when it comes to how we're going to finance the interim carve-out of both our medium-term leverage guidance and also our ability to deliver. In terms of restrictions from current indentures, we've got two incurrence covenants. There's a fixed charge coverage ratio and there's a senior secured leverage ratio, and we're comfortably the right side of both of those incurrence covenants.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
The next question comes in from the line of Michael calling from Credit Sites. Please go ahead.
Hello, hi. Thank you for the time. I have a few questions as well. I know last quarter and during the roadshow you gave quite a bit of detail on default rates on default rates. I was wondering if you could give some color on how default rates were during the time period going back to from 07, which you gave on the collections versus forecasts. The other thing I was looking to have some qualitative color on is what are you seeing on GMM's IRRs and pricing environment in your various regions. The other thing I had was looking at your P&L, I saw your other expenses go up quite a bit this quarter, and I was wondering if you could just explain explain that in a little bit more detail. And two more. One is, in your after the interim acquisition, How quickly are you looking to ramp up portfolio purchases in those markets, and what's your thought process around that? And then the last question on the interim acquisition, is it your intention for that entity to sit within the restricted group once you raise finances for that acquisition? Thank you.
Sorry, could I ask you to repeat the first point on interim? Sorry.
Just wanted to check that the interim acquisition will sit within the restricted group.
Okay, that one's easy. Yes. And I'm sorry, what was the other one? There was something about ramp-up activity, sorry.
Oh, sure, that was given that you now have a lot of exposure to new markets in the Nordic region. I was wondering, how are you looking to what's your thought process on portfolio purchases in that region? Are you looking to ramp up portfolio purchases quickly? Get comfortable or have some experience with the market before doing so? Just what's your thought process?
Okay. Let me pick up on that one while Colin gathers thoughts on the other questions. So I guess this is, we're buying a business that clearly is already a sophisticated player in its own markets and, has clearly demonstrated strong track record in being able to deploy capital successfully in those markets. So clearly we only expect to, as a combined group and team, further enhance our abilities between us. So, I don't envisage there being big step changes basically in terms of, how we deploy capital, because they've been doing that pretty successfully in the past. That being said, from what we've seen, the market is very buoyant and there seems to be a plethora of opportunities that obviously fit within our attractive return criteria.
So would that mean you would think the relative exposure to ERC in the Nordic region post-closure of the acquisition will modestly increase over time?
I expect it to continue to grow as it has done in the past and obviously in line with our overall strategic growth.
Okay. Thank you.
And then if I maybe pick up the first three points that you mentioned. So firstly, in terms of default rate, we haven't gone back and calculated what the default rate is all the way through back to the periods which we've demonstrated our outperformance relative to our ERC. We think that's really the appropriate measure to focus on. We don't have a consistent definition going all of the way back. And equally, clearly, the last recession saw too many variables in comparison. There's a different era. There's different affordability criteria. And clearly, things have been tightened since 2006. In terms of gross money multiples, we are not seeing any strange movements in terms of the individual regions. The UK is recording a gross money multiple of around 2x. DAC has had a gross money multiple in the year to date of 3.3x. That's slightly down from the 3.7, which I believe, if I remember, was recorded at Q2. That just reflects the fact that we had one particularly positive acquisition in that quarter, and we've now returned to a degree more normality in the subsequent quarter.
Can I have two follow-ups on what you just said? So on the UK GMM, are you seeing the unsecured GMM scores, are they staying very fairly constant? And then on the breakage rates point, when you pre and post last recession, did you see much volatility on breakage rates? If you can't actually give the exact numbers.
So again, given the fact that our book consists of 1 in 5 adults in the UK, there clearly are going to be segments within a portfolio that do change depending on whether they're, for instance, homeowners or others, for instance. But given the fact that we have coverage of 1 in 5 adults, there clearly can't be any concentration risk. So on a blended basis, there's very, very, very little movement.
Thank you.
And then in terms of the gross money multiples, we're seeing them very stable.
Okay, perfect. Thanks. So I guess the last question was on other expenses on the P&L.
Yep. So, it's a strange old quarter in terms of other OPEX, because there's a couple of different dynamics which are at play. Firstly, it's the first full quarter whereby we include all of the costs associated with TESH, but obviously we get the benefit of the income coming through as well. But then also included in that other OPEX line, we've got around $5 million worth of non-recurring or exceptional costs, which obviously represents a bit of a headwind when you make comparison quarter on quarter. I think the thing which I'd always try and encourage everyone to do is to step back and rather than look at quarter on quarter, look to see what's happening in terms of our operating profit on a year-to-date basis. I think it's a far better proxy for our business development rather than focusing upon only one element of the cost line and one individual quarter. If you look at the last 9 months comparison of our operating profit, we're showing around a 10% growth story. You know, I've said before, I'll say again, looking at individual quarters in isolation is always dangerous, not least because we don't run the business on a short-term quarterly basis. We run on a longer-term basis, and we're very confident in terms of our long-term growth trajectory.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you would like to ask a question, it's star one on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes in from the line of Peter Stalens. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the call. I had a couple of questions. First of all, I read somewhere that the industry won't be able to pass on credit card fees to the payers from January onwards. Is that true? And if so, can you roughly quantify the impact that's going to have on your business?
Yep, that one's easy. We don't add credit card fees to consumers anyway. It's against our own internal policy.
Okay, perfect. Then I also had a question on the Intrum acquisition. When I look at slide 18, you talk about 118 million of EBITDA. Then on slide 20, you've got 104 million of EBITDA. And I think when I read the Intrum press release, they talk about 55 million of EBITDA. Can you sort of reconcile these numbers for me, please?
Yeah, understandably, I can understand that question. So there's a couple of different dynamics at play here. One is different currencies. So there is euro and there is sterling. And then secondly, there is the difference between accounting EBITDA and cash EBITDA, with obviously cash EBITDA being the outcome of cash collection and the accounting EBITDA being the construct of yield and revaluation.
Okay, thanks. And then my final question is sort of, I'm trying to sort of update my model here. And when I look at your portfolio acquisitions during the quarter, you've acquired 52 million. You collected 125 million. So if I assume a 2.5 times gross money multiple on that 52 million, I get to about 130 million. So I thought your ERC should be roughly flat quarter on quarter, but it seems to have gone up by 67 million. What's the what am I missing here?
So clearly, we've always got to be careful. I think, as I've said earlier in the conversation, about making judgments on individual quarters, and equally in terms of doing the, I guess, reasonably simplistic analysis as to implied gross money multiples. I think the thing which you might be missing is the revaluation effect. So we've been collecting so well in comparison to our static pool expectations that obviously the curve is lifted, that revaluation comes through, and it's an additional element to the purchases as recorded in the ERC.
Because I thought that was 27 million in your accounts. So I'm still sort of missing like 40 million. Or is that FX or?
So the revaluation number is clearly going to be discounted, reflecting the EIR of the individual portfolio, whereas you're doing an ERC calculation, which is a gross cash collection.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
The next question comes in from the line of Luca, calling from ICG. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Question for Colin, I would say. Just on the securitization in the DACH region that you have started using, can you remind me the size you have available and if possibly can disclose the margin you pay on that, and then exactly how it works? Do you need to kind of, do you provide collateral and you get a kind of a certain LTV against that?
Yeah, of course I can, Luca. So this is an existing SPV within the DACH region, which is holding well-aged assets that we're now actually securitizing for the third time. I think we were quite pleased to be able to reactivate it because we think it represents an attractive coupon. It's in line with our RCF. Unfortunately, given the commercial sensitivity, I'm not going to disclose the actual rate at this time, but I would say that the rate's attractive, as I say, in line with the RCF and well below our recent high-yield bond coupons. In terms of the amounts, we've drawn down 14 million on the facility. That represents around 70% of the book value of the assets which have been pledged. And I think that probably covers the main facets of your question.
And do you have, and the total size of the facility is just, what is it? So the 70% is the amount drawn or the LTV that you need to?
It is the amount which is drawn, which also corresponds to the size of the facility.
Okay. Perfect. Okay, thank you.
The next question comes in from the line of Christian calling from CQS. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. There's been some market commentary which sort of assumes that the cost to collect goes in a linear relationship to ERC, which seems to be slightly different to how you've explained it in the past. I was just wondering if you think there's any merit in that or how it's best to model cost to collect.
Thanks, Christian. I was wondering if we were going to get a question in terms of the different perspectives which exist on the sector at present. I think in answer to your explicit question, I think myself and others are very confident that if you were to run a model of a runoff scenario, which predicts the doomsday that we're not able to purchase anything else, which in itself is highly unlikely, then we're going to have to be a little bit more sophisticated than assuming that the service cost ratio that the business has now represents the service cost ratio of the future. It simply doesn't. You know, our current service cost ratio, I think, reflects the fact of two different dynamics. The first, that we are a growing business, and therefore there is a sizable part of our estimated remaining collections which is relatively immature in terms of our own ownership. But then secondly, because of the type of debt that we purchase being non-performing, we also have a very front-loaded cost to collect curve. So as a consequence, the lifetime cost to collect ratios are going to be way lower than the current ratio that we've got. You know, historically, we've directed people to think about the lifetime service ratio for non-performing debt to be around 25% and for paying to be around 10%. So any analysis of a runoff, which assumes a constant service cost ratio of our current rate, I would argue is potentially inherently flawed.
What would you recommend? How is it best to model cost to collect? Should we look at your acquisitions and then sort of, is that the best way of doing it?
Yeah, I think that's probably not a bad way to do it, is to think about how the service cost ratio is likely to drop in keeping with the shape of our collections curve, probably staggered a little bit in terms of being slightly more front-loaded, but largely following the shape of the collections curve over time in order to arrive back to those blended lifetime cost ratios that I've just mentioned.
Okay, great. Thank you.
We have another question coming in from the line of Manu calling from Reorg Research. Please go ahead.
Hi, sorry, one last question from me. I forgot about this one. I saw that there was a new protocol when you basically go to people to collect their debt. I understand this is like a first letter of claim is sent, clearly stating what rights the borrower has, and I think they can request documentation and stuff like that. I was just wondering, since that was rolled out, have you seen any change in behavior, or is it taking a bit more longer to actually collect?
Yeah, one, I guess, is a little bit too early to say fully, but the simple thing is today we're not seeing any difference. And we were well prepared for that well in advance. So, again, we were obviously participant to in putting our ideas into that debt and pre-action protocol as well.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
The next question comes in from the line of Michael Murphy. Please go ahead.
Hi there, gents. It's Mike Murphy from Wells Fargo Asset Management. Just a couple of quick questions. First of all, could you just confirm with the interim acquisition, are there any servicing assets going with those ERCs as well? The slide deck seems to state that you're buying the whole businesses. Looking at the price you paid, it looks like you didn't pay much for those servicing businesses if they go with it. Could you talk a little bit to that, please? And then secondly, could you confirm for us that post the completion of the acquisition of those interim assets and their financing, that LTM net debt to ERCs will be pretty much in line with what we have now? Thanks.
Okay, Mike, let me pick that up. We are definitely picking up the servicing business in addition to a debt purchase business in all of the geographies. We think that it's a great complement to our existing business mix, and if anything, it actually enhances the amount of 3PC capital light income that we expect to generate. So I think it'll actually move our proportion of cash income from around 20% coming from 3PC up to around 30%. Mm-hmm. In terms of post-acquisition and leverage levels, clearly I'm very mindful of the fact I don't want to give too much in terms of guidance at this stage as to how we'll finance the deal, but I'm more than happy to recommit that over the medium term, we anticipate being able to drift back down below that 4.5 times net debt to adjusted EBITDA.
And sorry, just on that point, is that do you intend to keep your net debt to ERCs, which is kind of, I think, the sector leverage that we look at, around these kind of levels as well, or could that change a little bit?
So I would think that, you know, it's not a metric that we proactively track, because we think that the net debt to EBITDA is a more appropriate measure for a CMS business. We think the net debt to ERC is probably more appropriate if you are either predominantly or exclusively a balance sheet business and a sole debt purchaser. Having yep. said, I would anticipate that the metric would drift down in time, probably slightly before the net debt to adjusted EBITDA number, as sure. the business continues to evolve.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we've got time for probably just one more question.
Okay, so our final question comes in from the line of Raj Mittal. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, thanks. Just in terms of, you correctly described ERC as a very important first step in the valuation of your underlying book. But then if we need to deduct the cost of collection and then discount it back, is there a good reason? That's effectively what the accounts are doing on the balance sheet. But obviously that number ends up being apparently too low. So how do I, because that's just 900 million at the moment, so how do I best kind of adjust that balance sheet number for what you think, you know, is a better way to look at the net value of the collections on a discounted basis?
So it's an interesting one, because clearly the balance sheet is derived not from a cost of capital being applied to the gross ERC. It's reflective of the individual EIR, which is calculated within each individual portfolio. Clearly, the gross ERC has no discount applied to it. So I can see you're trying to think about how do we reconcile the two, how do we think about the two. Clearly, the thing which I would say from the outset is, if you're trying to get to a net cash flow outside of discounting, then as I've said already, applying the current service cost ratio would be inherently flawed. I think, you know, I've tried to give a degree of direction as to how people can think about how our service cost ratio unwinds over time, and I just refer you back to the previous answer. The one thing which I would say in terms of then trying to find a time value for money and applying an appropriate discount rate is that clearly the gross ERC was an industry metric which evolved in order for people to do the LTV calculation that Mike just talked about, which is comparing gross ERC to gross debt. If you do wish to start thinking about trying to do an NPV of the ERC, whether that be at a gross or a net level, then again, think back to the purpose of the metric, then presumably we'd also be looking to apply the same discount rate to our gross debt.
No, I'm sorry, the gross debt and gross ERC are very different types of gross, right? I mean, if you wanted to take gross debt that way, you would be adding back all the future interest cost on all the debt that's on the balance sheet. That would be the equivalent gross number. I mean, the gross ERC, you have a cost to collect. So the money coming in, which you're going to use to pay back debt, you know, you need to look at the net money coming in, and you need to look at the total cost that needs to be paid out. So that's not, it's not really, it cannot be the ERC cannot really be the denominator in a value calculation. It's like saying total future revenue of a company, right? It doesn't really work that way.
I'd agree with your latter point. We've never tried to present gross ERC as a value dynamic or as a means to value these businesses. We're trying to just show what the gross cash collections are, and the intent in the name, I guess. It's our gross estimate of what our expected remaining collections are.
Yes, exactly. So Yeah, I guess the point still comes back to what the right discount rate is, because if you were to try and sell your assets in the open market, to your competitors, I presume they will charge or they would expect to make a return which is similar to the EIR that you're charging on the balance sheet?
I guess that's a hypothetical debate. We're not seeking to sell the assets on an open market basis.
Of course not, but I'm looking at what the appropriate discount rate is. I'm looking at how the market prices these assets.
I guess we're in danger of straying into an esoteric debate. It depends upon what individual's marginal cost of debt, what their expectation of returns is to derive what's an individual rate which is appropriate to an individual calculation.
Sure. Okay. Thanks. And in terms of the ERC for the acquired business, I noticed that on the slide you quoted 180-month number, like you do for DAC as well. I presume there will be the information on the in terms of going forward on your slides. It would probably be more useful for us to continue using a 120-month number, just so that everything is comparable.
Okay. Roger, I think we'll probably end up doing both. I think,
okay,
you know, it's accepted practice in the Nordics that the collection window allows for and they can demonstrate collections over the 180 months. So I think it's appropriate to include that. But your point around comparability is clearly as ever spot on. So we'll make sure that we continue to provide both.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, may I thank you once again for what's been clearly a very long call. We've obviously had a lot to say. We are very excited by both the trading, the robustness of the business model, and the fact that the acquisition of the Intrum carve-out allows us to take forward our very clear strategy and allows us to enhance what is already a very robust business model. So with those parting words, thank you once again for both your support and your time today, and have a great week for what's left of it. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's call. You may now replace your handset.